You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm Mike Brown, author, nerd, and host of the Dark Poutine podcast. Join me and Morgan Knudsen, author, paranormal researcher, and host of the TV shows Paranormal 911 and Haunted Hospitals, as we take you on a journey for the curious about the unseen, the mysterious, and the incredible things happening in the world about us. Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances. The word vampire brings to mind, for most, terrifying images of mythological, bloodthirsty, undead, once-human creatures that rise from their graves at night, driven by an insatiable need to feed on the life's blood of unsuspecting human victims. According to an article by Philippe Bostrom from Heretz.com, quote, "Fear of demons and the undead has stalked humanity since prehistory. The oldest indication that living people feared unholy resurrection may be a site in Jordan, where prehistoric villagers enigmatically dismembered the dead 9,000 years ago. Some archaeologists postulate that the post-mortem mutilation was done to prevent them from rising again. What the beliefs were in the millennia before writing can only be inferred. But finally, writing would develop, and over 4,000 years ago, as texts attest, belief in demonic beings that, at the least, consume blood were prevalent in Mesopotamia and northern Africa. By the time of ancient Babylon over 4,000 years ago, the spirit was clearly believed to survive the physical body. Rituals and amulets were created to prevent these supernatural beings from molesting the living, and at about the same time, in the deserts and wastelands of Sumer, demons named Lilitu and Dime were believed to prowl in the night in search of victims to drain of blood and life force. Despite the occurrence of vampiric creatures in these ancient civilizations, the folklore for the entity known today as the vampire originates almost exclusively from early 18th century southeastern Europe, when verbal traditions of many ethnic groups of the region were recorded and published. In most cases, vampires are revenants of evil beings, suicide victims, or witches, but they can also be created by a malevolent spirit possessing a corpse or by being bitten by a vampire. Belief in such legends became so pervasive that in some areas it caused mass hysteria and even public executions of people believed to be vampires. The myth of what a vampire is and how they appear have changed and morphed over the millennia. Most people are familiar with Bram Stoker's Dracula and, Stephanie Meyer's popular Twilight series. But what is a vampire, really? Do they exist? There are some people who not only claim that vampires are real, but they themselves identify as one of the infernal creatures in the flesh. In this episode, Morgan takes a deeper look at vampire lore, and later on, we'll hear from notable Australian vampirologist, president and founder of the Vampire Studies Association, and editor of the Journal of Vampire Studies, Anthony Hogg, as we take a look at humanity's fascination with vampires. Here's Morgan.
It's difficult to make a single definitive description about the folkloric vampire. Though in Europe, there are some common elements: bloated, ruddy, purple, fat from the recent drinking of blood from victims. Not exactly the suave and sparkly image that we have today, is it? They sure weren't sweeping the ladies off their feet or yearning for undying love. Blood was often seen seeping from their mouths and nose, their left eye open, and it was usually clad in linen, not tuxedos. Its dirty fingernails, teeth, and hair were elongated, and usually fangs weren't a feature. While some folks describe them as the undead, many describe them as living beings. In Slavic and Chinese traditions, if an animal of any kind jumped over a corpse, it had the potential of being one of the undead, a body with an untreated wound, which had not been cared for with boiling water, was also a potential hazard. And in Russia, if you rebelled against the Orthodox Church, odds are you would probably be a vampire when you died. Why? Because, well, you must have been a witch in life. The typical vampire we see depicted in films is not the only place we see elements of blood-drinking monsters. In cryptozoology, a strange animal known as the chupacabra, or the goat sucker, is a constant and persistent risk to chickens, sheep, and other livestock. Animals are regularly found with puncture marks in their neck and the blood drained from the body with no evidence of blood in the area. People have reported seeing a 4-foot-tall creature with large eyes hanging around chicken coops, which they believe is the culprit, although descriptions vary wildly, and in recent years, a strange, hairless, unidentified canine has donned the name. It is now photographed regularly and has been seen on police dash cams, as well as physical bodies recovered and stuffed. No matter what lore or description you subscribe to, an age-old question appears from this muddle of legend. What creates a monster? Is it their frightening appearance? Their ability to come back from the dead? Their deadly attacks? Or does it have more to do with the innate fear of losing our own mental functions to something over which we have no control? Many cases of similar creatures, the Layak of Bali, the Asanabonum of Ghana, the Akimu of Mesopotamia, the Asima from Suriname, and others, not only cause others to turn into otherworldly creatures, but in the case of the German Nine-Tutor, it kills by spreading its own disease. Its name translates to the killer of nine, because it is believed it takes 9 days to die once you see the creature. In a similar fashion, the First Nations Wendigo, or Witiko, is feared for the same reason. If it attacks you, you not only risk death, but risk becoming another Wendigo. Your family becomes your target, and the sense of home that you once trusted becomes a battlefield. The Asima is known to seep through walls as bright balls of blue energy, draining the victim's blood while they sleep. Seeds, nails, and garlic are the only hope of defending yourself against this energetic monster. Many of the features we see in the vampire lore blanket the fear of losing our faculties and giving in to our most frightening primal ways, eating one another and having no choice in the matter. It also highlights another fear, the fear of an attack we can't see coming. Whether it be a vampire that takes on the appearance of a ball of light, or a seductive lover, or a family member turned vicious, the attacks all come from places we don't expect and people we trust when we are at our most vulnerable and where we offer trust. The idea of feeling uncertain regarding what happens to us after we die also plays a role here. The vampire or the victims are stuck in some kind of purgatory, a living hell they can't seem to escape without the relief of another person's actions, such as killing them in some specific way or ritual. In the Bayou, the Rougarou falls to the same traditions, a werewolf curse that holds a person captive until someone cuts them and causes blood to spill. Only then, it is said, can they be cured. Although there are plenty of Rougarou tales and stories about how it came to be, the idea of a curse that someone cannot control is a theme through many. I see a similar stream of thinking in the world of hauntings, and as a researcher, I am often surprised at how many still adhere to the idea that spirits get stuck and need to be crossed over, a line of thinking that goes back to the days of the church, where parishioners were required to pay the church money to get their loved ones out of purgatory. Despite there being no parapsychological evidence that this is the case, the trope persists in television, media, and popular thinking. The fear of these vampire monsters has been so great over the years that people have become desperate to recognize these traits before they get hurt. Nowadays, we tend to reach out to psychology, seeking books on narcissism, psychopathy, or sociopathy to avoid potential human predators. We fear running into monsters that we simply don't see coming. Being frightened, our instinct might fail us, and we might miss a critical warning sign. We translate this same behavior into our mythos as well. How do we stop the thing we can't see from sneaking up on us when we are unaware? One method of finding a vampire's grave involved leading a virgin boy through a graveyard or church grounds on a virgin stallion. The horse would supposedly balk at the grave in question. Generally, a black horse was required, although in Albania, it should be white. Holes appearing in the earth over a grave were taken as a sign of vampirism. Corpses thought to be vampires were generally described as having a healthier appearance than expected, plump and showing little or no signs of decomposition. Even poltergeist or psychokinetic activity has been blamed on the possibility of a vampire lurking about. Things, again, that we now know are often generated by the human themselves. So perhaps that's a clue. The fear of other humans has been a long-held issue amongst the human race. We fear other cultures, other races, other belief systems, strangers, neighbors, and especially dead bodies. The fear of dead bodies is come by honestly. We learned early on that bodies emit diseases and deadly gases upon decomposition. They bring rats and bugs and plagues. We feared corpses for a good reason. And couple that with a general fear of other humans hurting us in some way, it isn't hard to see how the psychology of the vampire begins to come together. During the 18th century, there was a frenzy of vampire sightings in Eastern Europe, with frequent stakings and grave diggings to identify and kill the potential revenants. Even government officials engaged in the hunting and staking of vampires. Despite being called the Age of Enlightenment, during which most folkloric legends were quelled, the belief in vampires increased dramatically, resulting in a mass hysteria throughout most of Europe. This controversy spread like wildfire and began when there was an outbreak of alleged vampire attacks in East Prussia in 1721 and then in Habsburg monarchy in 1725 to 1734, which spread to other localities. Two infamous vampire cases, the first to be officially recorded, involved the corpses from Serbia. One man was reported to have died at the age of 62, but allegedly returned after his death, asking his son for food. When the son refused, he was found dead the following day. He supposedly returned and attacked some neighbors, who died from loss of blood. In a second incident, an ex-soldier turned farmer, who allegedly was attacked by a vampire years before, died while haying. After his death, people began to die in the surrounding area, and it was widely believed that he had returned to prey on his neighbors. The two incidents were well documented. Government officials examined the bodies, wrote case reports, and published books throughout Europe. The hysteria, commonly referred to as the 18th century vampire controversy, raged for a generation. The problem was exacerbated by rural epidemics of so-called vampire attacks, undoubtedly caused by the higher amount of superstition that was present in village communities, with locals digging up bodies and, in some cases, staking them. Dom Augustin Calme, a French theologian and scholar, published a comprehensive treatise in 1751 entitled Treatise on the Apparitions of Spirits and on Vampires or Revenants, which investigated the existence of vampires, demons, and specters. Calme conducted extensive research and amassed judicial reports of vampiric incidents and extensively researched theological and mythological accounts as well, using the scientific method in his analysis to come up with methods for determining the validity for cases of this nature. The controversy in Austria only ceased when Empress Maria Theresa of Austria sent her personal physician to investigate claims of vampiric entities. He concluded that vampires did not exist, and the Empress passed laws prohibiting opening the graves and the desecration of bodies, sounding the end of the vampire epidemics. Other European countries followed suit. Despite this condemnation, the vampire lived on in artistic works and local folklore. Although these creatures are still present in theatrical works, movies, and books today, the vampire begs bigger questions than simply an option for a Halloween costume. They are an opportunity to glimpse the deepest fears of humanity. For wherever vampire fears lurk, exists a people who tread on unstable ground, the fear of the unknown, and the willingness to believe that what we do not understand will ultimately kill us or destroy us in some way, gives way to beliefs that can do far more damage than a fanged monster sneaking into our rooms at night. It is the same fuel that causes accusations, isolation, and a lack of critical thinking and invested understanding, and the closing of minds. Perhaps the greatest damage a vampire can do is to not show up at all, but rather the fear of the vampire itself is enough to begin to create a disease in the mind. If we fear thy neighbor, the plague of the vampire begins to seal doors, close windows, and shut down hearts. Strangers become threats and potential monsters with no evidentiary basis other than the rumor mill. Conversation stops, and a new plague begins without a vampire ever setting foot on the ground. So, what creates a monster? Perhaps it is a lack of garlic, superstition, or not burying a body in the right direction. Or perhaps it is fear. Perhaps it's our own innate fear of the unknown, looking back at us in the mirror, that makes vampires a unique type of horror.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm your inner dream monologue. And you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
It is our pleasure and just with absolute utmost fascination, Anthony, to have you on Supernatural Circumstances today, because Mike and I, about a year ago, we were discussing this idea and this concept of vampires, and not in terms of I think what most people are familiar with today in terms of films and things like that, but just this other level of vampiric folklore and all of these amazing things that's attached to it. And so thank you, first of all, for coming on and joining us today.
Yeah, that's right. We're happy to be here.
So what was your initial interest in vampires and the lore? What got you started in this?
Well, before my interest in vampires, I was actually already interested in the supernatural. So around the age of 8, I got interested in monsters and ghosts and all that kind of thing. And that evolved into an interest in mythology. And then at around when I was starting grade 6 back in 93, I caught a viewing of Fright Night Part 2, the 1989 or 88 version on TV, and there's something about it that really hooked me. And I think it was a confluence of the kind of the monster hunting role that you see in mythology, you know, the heroes versus the monsters, the lore that's associated that with that. So like the little tropes and little rules that folklore type that follows that you also see in mythology as well, and it's very hard to put my finger on. Even as many times as I've kind of wondered about it, I don't know what specifically gravitated to me towards that. But after I watched that movie, I read as much as I could on the subject. I really got stuck into it. You know, I raided my school library, I raided my public libraries, whatever I could read on the subject. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became with the subject, you know. So it kind of, my early exposure was to works like, I guess it was good timing too, because around about this time there had been a kind of resurgence of interest in vampires because of the movie Bram Stoker's Dracula coming out in 92. Right. So there was a lot of material to kind of draw on. I remember reading books by Rosemary Ellen Guiley. J. Gordon Melton came out with his encyclopedia, you know, in 94, so not long after. So there was a good body of material to draw on at the time. So it could have just been a bit of a stroke of luck.
Oh, wow. Yeah, like I think throughout the time that Mike and I have been doing this podcast, we've really realized that there really are no accidents, and it's neat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's true, and it's so interesting to hear your story, because I can relate to that in so many ways, where, I mean, just my interest early on, it just is started in a very similar way to yours. It's like I had an actual experience and whatnot, but I found myself just immersed in the subject matter of the paranormal, and it's neat to know that, you know, other people have had the same experience. So being in Australia, how has the concept of vampires manifested there? Have you noticed that it's a different lore, or is it, you know, very similar to other parts of the world?
That's a good question, because in Australia, just like Canada, actually, we've got two levels of cultural experience. So we've got our Indigenous population,
right?
And you've got the Western colonial kind of influence. So on the Aboriginal front, the closest thing off the top of my head that we have to like a vampire tradition is the Yarramahu, which is a kind of like a bogey that lives up in a tree, and it kind of grabs people walking below that tree and kind of picks them up and sucks their blood. I'm very paraphrasing big time here, because it's been a long time since I read about it. I just ran out of breath there. Long time since I've read about it. And that's the main one. I don't think there is much in terms of, I mean, when we kind of broach that idea, we've got to really consider what a vampire is. That's an eternal semantic question,
right,
when it comes to vampire studies. Because, like, when we talk about the vampire being a global phenomena, what we're saying is there's got to be some kind of template to even call it a vampire in the first place. So if we look at where we get the word from, and I do apologize for dovetailing into this, but I just got to give it
no,
that
this
kind
is,
of
this is
context.
No, this is great. Please,
well,
go ahead. This is what...
but if where we get the word vampire from is from Serbia, it's a Serbian vampire, and it was basically a reference to an undead blood-sucking corpse. So when we look at that in a global perspective, That's not a reoccurring phenomena. That's not something that's everywhere. What you might get is elements of that template. So it might be a being that drains energy, or, you know, it might be, instead of a person, it might be a demon, or it might be a spirit or something like that. So we're using a very loose and rough definition of what a vampire is. So, and of course, the concept of vampirism is very flexible in terms of how you apply it as a terminology. So when we talk about it being, like, say, in the native traditions, you know, I'm talking about some kind of demonic or kind of monstrous entity. But if I was to apply the Slavic model, then it would be much more rarer. So that particular model influences the Western concept of vampires, you know. So what you said earlier about film and you know, books and that kind of thing. So in Australia, with that on that front, it's very kind of, let's say, very kind of rare. But I actually did visit a cemetery back in 2016, Toowong Cemetery in Queensland, which has a story of a vampire there as well. And the way that the vampire is described there, it's, you know, it was found, it was, you know, unearthed, it had ruby red lips and fangs and all this kind of stuff. And the description, it was very much in terms of like a 19th century literature version of what a vampire is. Because if we go back beyond that, then all a vampire really was, at least in the Slavic tradition, was a corpse that had remained fresh in the grave, and occasionally they might find blood pouring out of its mouth or in its coffin or something like that. The fangs thing is an addition that comes later on.
Really?
And mainly through literature, absolutely. You know, so when we talk about, you know, the most iconic feature of a vampire being its fangs, that is a later addition to it, because like any kind of folklore, the concept has evolved with each retelling and our popular perception of it. You know, we are using a term right now, vampire, that came into English in 1732 in reference to a vampire pandemic in Serbia, but it didn't start there. That was kind of like the crystallization of the idea of what a vampire is. It's kind of lingered in our popular consciousness. But before then, it was a kind of idea that evolved over time. Like there's a lot of overlap in Slavic tradition with the vampire and the upia, which is like a general description for ghosts or the undead returning. And so even the blood-sucking motif is something that happens much later as well, in the last few hundred years, I would say. You know, so much of what we think we know about them is fairly recent in terms of the modern viewpoint of stuff. And in the Australian context, that's what's influenced our point of view. You know, it's very, very heavily influenced by, you know, Western culture, British and American in particular. So our traditions here are much more new as well to reflect that. You know, you won't get much beyond it. And everything else is an embrace of popular culture, apart from some like kind of Aboriginal influences that are kind of a blend of the two as well. So I think you'll find manifestations of that all over the place, even I would say in your country too, you know.
Yeah.
That's
really
so
interesting.
That is actually one of the things that got me interested in the first place. I started getting into the kind of idea of debunking what we kind of think we know about vampires. The more you read about it, the more you learn, the more you start to see. Actually, funnily enough, now that we're mentioning Canada, a big part of my influence in that regard was actually a Canadian scholar named Elizabeth Miller, who was very much a game changer in terms of modern Dracula scholarship. But her approach was to debunk a lot of theories about the book, about Dracula itself. So I kind of applied that to vampire studies itself, you know, our concept of what a vampire is. But the more I've learned again, the more I realise that the idea is more flexible than we kind of give it credit for. So that's where there's a war within myself of a conservative approach versus a more kind of looser liberal approach to the idea. So it's just something that kind of refines in me a lot. Yeah,
that's really interesting. And it's interesting what you're saying about the folklore and the traditions and whatnot as well, like here in Canada, and the West in general. Like, you know, we see these concepts kind of traced back in First Nations cultures, like the Abenaki and Cree.
It is very interesting. Yeah, absolutely, because it's more. You think about it this way, right? In our own culture, we've got urban legends, you know, and that is basically folklore, but for the cities, you know, it's folklore for the suburbs, for the towns, but the concept is the same. It's when people tell stories to each other, each time they do that, the story changes, you know, because you might add your own tweak, someone might embellish it somewhere, that story gets passed along and so on and so forth, to the point where it becomes a very amorphous kind of hazy thing that evolves as well, you know, like it evolves into a different idea. Our modern concept of vampire, what the vampire is a product of that same evolution, because each time it has been told, it has grown, you know, wings and taken flight, you know, and that's why authors have that flexibility to use their imagination with it. I've often seen, like on social media, groups, you know, like people talking about, oh, what would a vampire do? And you know, in this particular situation, if they're writing a book about it, I'd say whatever you want, because it's up to your imagination and what you do with it. So when people say vampires don't sparkle, well, according to who? According to the mythos of Stephanie Meyer, they do. But that's if you're subscribing to her particular kind of worldview of them. I mean, they're not real anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, so you can give it a cape, you can give it, you know, you can give it a top hat, you can do whatever you want with the thing, because it's already a product of imagination. So, you know, it depends very much on the context in which you use it. So, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So, there, like we've talked about, there's so many different types of vampires culturally. I mean, you've listed a few of them, and earlier in the podcast we'll be talking about a number of them as well. What are the vampire types or species that stand out to you as the ones that are the most memorable?
There was one, I recall reading about one, I think from South America. I can't remember its name off the top of my head. I remember reading about this long ago. It was, I think, a kind of vampire that sucked blood through people's ears with its nose.
That's a new one.
You get a lot of kind of interesting. Then, of course, you've got the Southeast Asian variants, where they tend to be like heads that detach themselves from bodies and, you know, kind of fly around at nighttime, that kind of thing. Having their entrails and whatever dragging behind them, you know, hanging from their neck. There's so many different, like I guess you would call species, and this is very much vampirologist Theresa Bain's kind of area. And it again shows you that in order to rationalize the vampire as a universal model, you've got to be very flexible with what you consider a vampire to be. You know, like, you know, is it alive? Is it dead? Is it, you know, what does it actually drink? What does it do? All that kind of thing. So, but the baseline of that is it's kind of a supernatural figure, because, you know, the ordinary person can't detach their heads from their bodies and go out in search of people to feed on, you know. So there's got to be some kind of mystical element to qualify it, I would say. But at the same time, you've got people who identify as vampires themselves, you know, living human beings like the rest of us. And then that's where you start to get into a whole new area of semantics too.
Yeah. So you've been editing for a while the Journal of Vampire Studies. How did you get into that? Because that is so interesting.
Well, for me, it was a byproduct of just reading about it. Eventually, I remember when I was first interested in it, I used to compile all these little pieces of lore that I found in various books, especially my biggest influence being Paul Barber's Vampires, Burial and Death, a book that came out in 1988. It was one of the first books I kind of really read or tackled on the subject. But all these lots of different pieces of lore, and then it got to a, I mean, between my interest in vampire studies itself, I actually wanted to write vampire novels. And so I compiled a bunch of story ideas and such. But while I was doing that, I was researching a bunch of things at the same time. And then that led me down a path of going into source material. So a lot of vampire studies today is rooted, or it was, in the writings that came out about them in the 18th century, particularly from Germany. And then, of course, you got more popular works by Augustin Calmet, which came out in the mid-18th century as well, about the subject. And I started to delve into that more. And by chasing sources, you know, going back to the original, that kind of blossomed into more of an interest into vampire studies itself, to study it, to go right to the heart of what a vampire was. And then that just, and I realized that there wasn't enough that I had been exposed to or read about it until I started to find like-minded people like Niels K. Peterson, who writes the Magia Post humor blog. So it comes from chasing up original kind of sources, because like I said with Elizabeth Miller before, kind of like a lot of what we know about the subject is kind of layer upon layer, second-hand, third-hand source recounting. So to really strip that back and to see if what's been represented is accurate, you go back to the source, you know, the classic kind of journalism model. And that made me see that there is something there in terms of a field that people can apply, you know, more integrity, more kind of scholarly principles to. And I'm not the first. I'm by far not the first person to kind of to articulate that or to kind of recognize it, but I put a lot of emphasis on it now because I don't feel like it has enough representation, you know, and I want that representation to occur more in a wider scale.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting too, how, you know, like you were saying, there's this finding the source material and trying to figure out, you know, where some of these things come from. And it seems to be such a common, like such a common theme through so many cultures. Why have you found that every culture seems to have some form of this, even cultures that have never spoken to each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, there's the influence of not the influence, the desire to kind of unify things, I think, is what drives that perception, you know, like a universal law that we're all kind of the same and all this kind of thing. But if you look at the undercurrent of it, and particularly with what I've mentioned with Paul Barber's work before, the approach that he took to the subject was, rather than just dismiss what they say as superstition, there must be a reason why they believed what they believed. So in the case of vampires themselves, earlier I mentioned the qualifier for identifying a vampire, and I'm talking specifically in a Serbian context of the era, so 18th century, was that the vampire was a body that, you know, had remained fresh in the grave after, you know, prolonged duration, occasionally found blood in its mouth. Now, we now know in the 21st century what can cause that kind of phenomena, which is, you know, the state of the soil, the weather conditions, you know, certain diseases, certain poisons, all that kind of stuff. There is a logical reason why a body can be preserved longer than it should be by normal standard. Now, at the time, they didn't have that concept, you know, so their science of what happens to a body after it dies is relatively more recent. So the thing that underlies all of these universalities is that the human experience itself. So another example is the vampire attack. So you get visited at nighttime, someone you recognize or a family member, a friend, villager, whatever, comes into your room. They lay down upon you, putting a weight on your chest, this kind of thing. This is why it pays to read those early descriptions. You know, if we rely solely on, you know, what we see on TV or the movies where, you know, they sneak in, bite your neck, that kind of thing, then you're missing the kind of the detail of the original. So what they're describing is very easily recognizable as sleep paralysis, right? You know. So that is a universal human experience. What we're really talking about is the human experience filtered through, you know, 1,000, 5,000 different cultural lenses. Yeah. But if you look at the common elements between them, you can see, okay, that explains why they believe that, because it's not something that only exists in a particular area. It might be, even in the case of actually what I've mentioned with sleep paralysis, there has been analogies drawn between that and alien abduction experiences, of ghost experiences, demonic experiences, all that kind of thing. And it doesn't just filter culturally, it filters individually. Sure. I mean, the individual, the person, you, me, everybody we know, is a culture unto themselves, because they've got their own experience, their own life experience, their own spiritual or non-spiritual views. So everything we recount in terms of experience phenomena is filtered through that lens. So, you know, the universal element behind all is the human experience itself. You know, it only changes depending on where you are, the time frame you're in. Like I said before, we have the benefit of hindsight. Yeah. But had we been living in the 18th century, we would have had no knowledge, and we would have had to have relied on what other authorities said on the particular subject. You know, the cases I'm referring to when I talk about bodies being, you know, found to be fresh is because people literally dug them up, you know, as a process of trial and error to find out what the cause of a particular outbreak of disease in a village would be. That sounds insane now, but back then it made perfect sense to them because that was a tradition that they had used to kind of explain the unexplainable, you know, and that applies across any kind of paranormal or any kind of supernatural thing where our knowledge of a particular subject, how we explain it, is limited by how much we know. And that is another filter, right?
Well, it's such a great point that you're bringing up. And actually, Mike and I, we've talked about, you and I have talked about this so many times before, where it's the, and actually with John Yost, a guest that we had recently, where it just seems like people are interpreting, you know, their experiences using simply the knowledge that they have. And Mike, you probably want to talk about that because, like, we had that conversation about the Spider-Man eyes.
Yeah, I don't know how deeply I want to get into that, but essentially when I was a kid, I had an experience where I woke up in bed and I saw this thing looking at me standing. It was, its head just stood just a little bit above the bed, and it had eyes that were shaped like almonds, and I described it as Spider-Man eyes. And I later, upon seeing a picture of a gray alien, said, no, that's what I saw. It was that kind of thing. So I guess I get it. What you're saying is how we look at things is just always filtered through what we have knowledge of, even creatively.
It's interesting to me that's like the theme, like the same sort of theme in terms of, you know, our consciousness and how people interpret events and things like that. It does all tend to connect. And you're right. Like, you know, I've seen this with paranormal phenomena too, especially within different cultures. You know, some of the classes that I've taught that have, you know, multiple different cultures sitting in the class. And, you know, you'll start talking about a really well-documented phenomenon. And, you know, everybody goes, oh, well, I know what that is. And then they'll repeat the story in their culture. And then someone else will put their hand up and say, oh, no, it's not that, it's this. And then it's another cultural tale. And
yes. Isn't that the funny thing? Because everyone thinks they're right, don't they?
Yeah, and it's like everybody's having the same experience.
Yes. And it's that's the filter at work, you know. It's like, and you can see why people take this stuff very personally, because it's a profound experience, isn't it? You know, it's something that, like, how dare you kind of say that this is, you know, just my imagination or something like that, because it's something that really impacts people. We could be talking about NDEs, we could be talking about, you know, other out-of-body experience and that. You can explain that stuff scientifically, but what you can't do is kind of rob people of something deeply personal to them, because, you know, whatever you say, it is going to be something that, you know, unless you experience it yourself, it's going to be a different kind of, and that's something I'm learning too, because, like, the filter we're talking about, you can apply empiricism to it, or you can say, just kind of hear them out and kind of listen to what they're talking about. But it's kind of, it's a very kind of a murky area, because on one hand, you don't want to be too accommodating to just blindly, you know, relaying just a whole bunch of things. And I commonly experience this in a lot of the Facebook groups I monitor, I admin, where people start talking about how they're, like, you know, descended from some kind of, you know, vampire ancestor, yeah, and they're coming from a royal bloodline, all this kind of stuff. All you need to do is ask to say two words to that, which is prove it. And then that's where it all starts to unravel. But what you see that there's a lot of kind of, you know, it is something embedded in a lot of people, you know, for different reasons and such. So it's kind of, it can be a bit of a fraught topic to navigate, you know. When I got into the subject myself, vampirism was bang, it's a superstition, you know, it's nonsense and all this kind of stuff. But when people start to bring up the universal experience, when they talk about identifying as vampires themselves, and things just get a lot more murkier when you start getting personal experience kind of thrown into it. But at the same time, you've got to have an objective, rational mind about it. Otherwise, you start to sink into that, go down the rabbit hole kind of a situation as well. So, you know, yeah, it is very interesting to get multiple viewpoints on it. And that is actually part of the drive of my interest in vampire studies too. It is not a one-track thing. It is a thing that exists with many minds pulled into it.
Yeah, it is a rabbit hole. Like it is so deep. And do you think that there is something to that idea that things like disease? I know there was a I watched a documentary years
rabies.
Ago. Rabies. Yeah, rabies. Exactly, like rabies, things like that. Is that a factor with this, or is that just rumor?
Oh, the rabies thing. The rabies thing. With the rabies thing, I'll say this: it's what we call the medicalization of a myth. So it's basically, this is an interesting phenomenon too, because it's you can tell when these theories are formed what they've been influenced by. So the rabies one, for example, there's a particular author who's written about this. I think his name is Juan Alonso Gomez, who said he got his idea for it from watching a movie about vampires. So that rabid kind of attack thing, and that leads you down the rabbit hole of, well, what kind of naturalistic phenomena would cause somebody to do that? And they generate all these kind of theories about it. But when you start to look at the theory itself and its influences, it can't be the explanation, because that kind of model of vampire in your head based on watching a movie did not exist. People cannot have been influenced by something they had no conscious knowledge of. Another one is bringing Canada into it again, because you guys have had a bigger impact than you realize. There's a biochemist or something like that named David Dolphin, who popularized the porphyria interpretation of vampire phenomena. You know, people who suffered tremendously from being out in the sun, you know, their skin burns up, their gums recede, so it looks like they have fangs, and they may have relied on blood to kind of to build up their, you know, their lack of vitamin deficiency or whatever. But he also got inspired by movies as well, you know. If you're using movies as a template to explain the vampire phenomena, then you're already on the wrong path, because they did not exist. And that is another filter once again, because it is an interpretation of what the original accounts were. And it doesn't make sense when you read them, because the typical template back then would be someone who had been dead for several weeks returning, and people would be seeing them and, you know, seeing them at night time or whatever, and then dying not long after. Mm. Now, rabies doesn't make you come back from the grave, right. As far as I know. It's not a symptom I'm familiar with. So you've got to explain that kind of process without kind of shunting it aside as, oh, no, they just made a mistake. You know, you've kind of got to really hone in on the detail of what they're talking about to explain it another way. There was even an 18th century scholar named George Teller who investigated one of these outbreaks in a Serbian village, and he determined that people were hallucinating based on their diets, because they were fasting for, say, Easter periods or Christmas or whatever. That's a religious example right there. And that was kind of screwing with their heads. And he's found that just by changing their diet, they stopped reporting this stuff. So every case you examine, there is no one-size-fits-all explanation. Every account is going to have its different explanation because you're already dealing with something that is perpetuated by a tradition, you know, like the rough storyline, but the way you reach that story is going to have a different series of steps as well. Because one example is outright hoaxing, you know, sure. Like I can think of, you know, that True Wong Cemetery example I gave you before. I'm telling tales out of school here, but I actually talked to someone who knew the tour guide who's kind of the guy who this story originates from. And in a private conversation, he told her, oh, yeah, it's just bullshit. You know, so there is flat out hoaxing. You know, we find that in, ghost tour kind of stuff. You know, I'm not going to say it for everybody, but I know that people will come up with stories just because, guess what, that's their job. Their job is to entertain, and there's so many different reasons. It's not just, a mistake of a phenomena. Sometimes it is just outright deception too. Or it could be just, you know, people just trying to explain something that they just don't understand. In the same way that people couldn't understand something 200 years ago, we're in a similar boat today. You know, that is the great unifier of human experience across the board, everywhere. In fact, I can even give another example of outright hoaxing in the 18th century or 19th century context. One of the traditions associated with vampires was that they would that a husband would return from the dead to sleep with his widow. Now, this actually got taken advantage of in at least one case where a local youth was visiting a young widow, and he would dress up in a shroud, you know, do the spooky noises kind of thing, and it kept people away, it scared them off. But eventually they busted him doing it. I forgot what happened to him after, but even back then they were taking advantage of people's fear on it to commit hoaxing activity, you know. So once again, the human experience manifests itself. It doesn't just exist in this age. It has always been there. So, you know, there's great commonalities across the board in that way. And the attempt to medicalize the myth is to give a nice one-size-fits-all explanation when what you're really dealing with is a variety of different phenomena, which, to give it its due respect, requires a different set of, reasons and explanation. You cannot do a one-size-fits-all. It does not work.
Yeah, I totally get that. And Mike, I think you like we've seen this as well with other things.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it doesn't matter which branch of paranormal that you're looking at. We always tend to run into this exact same situation where it's explained like that, like you just did.
Yeah, and so. On that subject, because this is to me where this can get kind of interesting, is that you know, you have these people that are, you know, out hoaxing, or, you know, the rumor that, you know, there's a vampire about or something like that back in, you know, whether it be the Middle Ages or whatever. At any point, was there almost like a witch trial type mentality with this? Like, was there enough panic that was causing a problem?
Yes, absolutely. Because there's an author named Bruce McClelland who's written about this. He's got a book which I advise your audiences to check out called Slayers and Their Vampires. And basically the vampire is a scapegoat. And so I'm going to generalize here. So the vampire, the idea is you've got unexplained deaths happening in a village. Something is causing it. Remember, we don't know about microbes or any kind of things like that at this time. So what is causing this kind of phenomenon? Well, hang on, it must be the person who's now currently sighted around the village, the most recently dead person. So let's dig them up and check out what's going on with them, you know. And we've got to remember as well, the vampire phenomenon is associated with other things too, like, cattle disease. There's even a scholar named, I think his name is Christian Reiter, I hope I've got his name right, who noted that the initial outbreak from where we get the term vampire from could have been caused by anthrax, anthrax outbreak that happened at that time. Yeah, very interesting stuff, a very interesting theory, which I hope sees more circulation in English because he wrote about it in German. The details are timed pretty well. But going on what I said before about the medicalization of a myth, that would need further scrutiny just to make sure the details kind of add up. But once again, it's like the root of it is trying to assign blame to a particular kind of person or figure. And I mean, in the case of vampires, at least the people were already dead. You know, in the case of witches, that's much more set of horrific circumstances there. But that drive to kind of assign blame for a particular tragedy or something like that, it's again, that's the human nature of things. We need an explanation, and it might not be one that sounds feasible in hindsight, but at the time it makes perfect sense. Going back even further to horrific things like the persecution of Jews, you know, during the Black Plague, where, you know, apparently the plague was caused by the poisoning wells and all this kind of stuff in certain regions, which again, we now know, of course, is caused by, you know, like a particular kind of, you know, virus or microbe or whatever it is, which they just had no concept of back then. So you've already got people who are fueled to kind of view certain types of people as outsiders. So I guess what happens when you get a disease or an outbreak, they must be the cause of it. It's them because, you know, for whatever reason that it's kind of like this social exorcism, you know, casting out the undesirables or the bad elements or the kind of purging in a society by projecting it onto something else and giving away an outlet for your frustration, for your, you know, lack of understanding on a subject and kind of punishing it. That kind of is the undercurrent behind these things. There must be some cause or blame rather than accept the possibility that we just don't know. I can't be sure, but, you know, this is a kind of a trick of the brain people have. You know, it's very hard for people to reconcile being uncertain. Yeah. That you know, we are driven towards some kind of explanation rather than being content with I don't know. And I'm not sure.
Isn't that
you
the
know?
Truth?
So we might have.
Yeah. That making peace with the unknown. It's such a struggle, I think, for so many people on so many levels, like not just with the paranormal, but just with everyday life. You know, just as soon as they don't know, that unsettled, you know, I don't know.
It's very unsettling. Yeah. I don't know. Like we've been dealing with that now with COVID. Yep. You know, everything we've been dealing with now is trial and error. You know, lockdowns, face masks, vaccines, everything. We're trying to find the best way to deal with this. And now we've been left with a tremendous economic impact as well across the globe. You know, even in my country too, where, you know, we're in this kind of twilight zone of having high employment, but also everything's going up, interest rates going up, petrol, all that kind of thing. So people are looking for the unknown, you know, like what's causes. I know what it was. It was, you know, a virus created in the lab in China, and this is all part of the Great Reset, and this is all planned. There's people doing this to us on purpose rather than accept the idea that, you know what, this is something that most of the world was just unprepared for. They're kind of trying to deal with it in the best way they can. You can either accept that or you can go, there are dark forces at work here. You know, we are being played, blah, blah. And that kind of drive is, again, the human experience at work. How you interpret something is going to depend on what your kind of, what you would gravitate towards. You know, like what I've just described is basically two sets of kinds of people with this, and which way you kind of go is kind of you see what I mean? It's basically that kind of where you steer to. There is something that drives that, and that's the psychological element behind all of this stuff. And that's the same drive that caused people to dig up corpses and hammer stakes with them and chop their heads off. in the name of stopping something they could not understand, but having a concrete explanation, which is, oh, it's a vampire, so we must destroy it, and then everything will get better. Right. That's the undercurrent behind it all.
So with, and so sort of to jump ahead a few thousand years, with these, you know, there's been people that have come forward over the years, and again, I think this comes back to what we were talking about before about the human experience and whatnot, where people are reporting, you know, even to this day, running into something that, you know, they can't explain, like a, you know, a stranger on the sidewalk and feeling hypnotized or coerced, or these sort of modern day encounters with what people, you know, believe are it, like a modern day vampire, or maybe not modern day, maybe something from a long time ago. And it's interesting to me that, like, even today, we still get people that report that, you know what, I was, you know, walking down the street, there was this weird guy, there was a time lapse, you know, I woke up, you know, feeling really weird, or, you know, whatever it is. And it's interesting to me that that, like, these reports still come through. And I don't know, do you think that there's some cultural expectation here? Again, is it something where people are just, you know, interpreting that because vampire is the closest thing that they could get to?
Yeah. See, that's exactly it, because that's the filter again. What's our closest explanation to what this must be? Because you're limited by your knowledge and by, I mean, even you can have the most advanced knowledge in the world, but there's going to be something that you do not know. So we are limited by the confines of whatever we can kind of ascribe something to. Like with these people who are experiencing this stuff, they're not like paranormal investigators by nature. They're not kind of scientists. They're not people who would have a grasp of, you know, potentially psychological phenomena or anything like that. And this is why I emphasize that each thing should be investigated individually. There's a book called Haunted Highgate by Della Farrant, where she has basically tried to coalesce all these diverse reports to kind of frame one kind of concept of what that phenomena was. So you're putting everything under one umbrella to kind of rationalize an outcome you already believe in, which is classic confirmation bias in action, you know. So when we collate stories and put them under a single banner, just the sheer collation itself makes it look like the phenomena is legitimate. But what you're not doing is taking the time to individually say, hang on, did this actually happen? Is there another explanation for this kind of thing? Because that requires a lot of work, you know, a lot of time and effort goes into doing that. So it's much easier to just take everything in one hand and go, oh, well, there you go. That's proof right there. But that's where we kind of become unstuck. You know, this is, again, the human mind kind of trying to make sense out of disparate patterns and kind of presenting a kind of half-baked outcome just so we have an explanation, just so we understand, we can give a name to it. Because once we give it a name, we have power over what that thing is. You know, it's trying to make sense of a chaotic world, because we're very much geared towards, you know, order and, you know, systems and rigidity, and anything that goes outside of that. And you can already tell, perhaps, you know, that you can apply this to so many different things. You know, we've currently got the abortion issue going on in America about what is a child. You've got the transgender issue of what is a woman, you know, all this kind of thing. Everything we took for granted has been challenged, and, you know, it's becoming a much bigger story, a much bigger picture. And you can apply that. This is what makes, I think, vampire stuff interesting. Even talking about it out loud, I realise how broad the application can actually be in terms of, you start breaking it down into general concepts and ways of thinking, and then you can see how it applies to virtually everything. In fact, a big part of my critical thinking skills came into it from, in, you know, exploring the dimensions of vampire cases. because I'm applying critical principles to something that I study, and that's why the study bit is so important. You know, not just taking it for, you know, for what it is, but delving into it, you know, and learning more and more about what constituted that phenomena in the first place. You know, this is everywhere around us. Everything you can think of, these same principles can be applied. You know, so that's the undercurrent behind
Absolutely.
It all.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm headed to London tomorrow, so I plan on visiting Highgate, and I'll let you know if I have any experiences there.
Yeah, we're going to be waiting, Mike. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating and unbelievably enlightening. I have learned so much in the last hour. I think almost more than any other podcast that we've done. Because the vampire issue is something that I've explored, but I've not known near as much about it as you've just you've just unpacked. Mike, what do you have to say about that?
Oh my gosh, yeah, my mind is blown. I have all these books to read now, like Slayers and Vampires. And...
Yeah, I definitely recommend checking those books out. I'll chuck in another one while I'm at it, while I'm on this hot streak. I'll say Jan L. Pekowski's Vampire Lore, which is a compilation of his writings on the subject. That's the Slavic vampire in particular. So what you've got here, what we've been talking about, is where you get something very specific, but you start to kind of broaden the horizon of what that is outwards, you know. So like there's all these concepts I've been talking to today, you can apply them across the board. Because what's the ultimate thing behind it? It's the human experience. So you could say, and that's where the study principle comes into it. Because the thing I like about studies is the critical thinking element, and that it has universal application. You know, the great unifier is scientific concepts and scholarship. You know, the concept of give a source where you've learned information from, scrutinize the truth of something. This can be applied across literally anything, you know. So I do understand how people kind of approach things, and the more you kind of talk about it out loud. In fact, I've got a friend of mine who's a philosopher, you know, I've caught up with him a few times. We just bantered about the world and all that kind of thing. And I think the ability to speak out loud, just like as you do with your podcast, interviewing people, all that kind of thing, is you start to formulate ideas just by bouncing off each other, you know. And I think that is a big appeal to me in terms of what's gotten me into the studies thing, finding out what other scholars have written about a subject, their own theories, learning more information, that kind of constant expansion of the mind, you know, but also keeping an anchor on it by having that critical process in place, you know, to scrutinize information and having the knowledge of how to do that. Very important.
Absolutely. Well, Anthony, where can people find you, and where can they find the Journal of Vampire Studies? Because I know our listeners are going to be wanting more information.
Yes. Okay. The Journal of Vampire Studies is available in all a variety of online bookshops like Amazon, Book Depository, you know, even Walmart. It's across the board. I at the moment I don't have a designated site for it, but that is something I'm working on. I have the Vampire Studies Association, which I preside over, has a website, which is vampirestudies, all one word, .org. They can reach me through that. And if they want to ask any questions or submit something to our journal or something like that, I'm always open to it. So I just love to hear what people have to say about the subject.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for doing this with us tonight. Mm-hmm. Say we learned a lot, and we really appreciate you being here.
Yes, I'm happy to. I thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you for reaching out.
Thank you.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Here's Morgan for this episode's segment of Spiritual Healthcare.
In this episode's edition of Spiritual Healthcare, the segment of the show where you get to be the creator and designer of your paranormal and spiritual experience, we're going to tell you about a process called finding presence. This is another great process for finding peace and bringing a sense of connectedness and spirit throughout your day, no matter how busy you are. The best way to begin this process is to find a tree or other living thing in nature. Flowers are also a great beginning point. As you take a few deep breaths, begin to observe the flower, but remove the label of flower. Observe it as if you had not ever seen one before. Look at it from the place of non-judgment when you quiet your mind. If thoughts arise, let them go and return to the tree or the flower. You can do this with inanimate objects as well, but it is often easier to do it with nature because it has the sense of aliveness you can easily observe. As you look, focus on your breath and again, remove any labels like this is a tree or leaves or petals and just observe the plants in their full, whole state of being. You will find the simple act of finding the presence of majesty will bring you in deep touch with your own spirit. You need nothing to be happy, but you need something to be sad. Remember, at the end of seeking, all is consciousness. Stay in peace, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Supernatural Circumstances, a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can find out more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and more about me and listen to my other show at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com. Good night for now.